I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and it's not a great way to start, but I'm going to begin by asking you to turn your telephones off. Telephones. Oh, God, I just dated myself there, didn't I? Cell phones. Okay, everybody's taking care of that. We'll move on. I want to first remind everybody, mark your calendars. We are off next week for spring break. I hope that, you're always welcome to come. The galleries stay open even when the Tuesday evening doesn't happen for the run of the program. So you could come and have a little extra time in the galleries. But we won't have any Tuesday evening lecture next week in honor of spring break. But I do want you to remind you to be back the following Tuesday, March 22nd, with the spectacular Mary Ellen Carroll. I hope you've looked into her work or are already familiar with her work. I think she's going to definitely be a memorable lecture. Her most recent project, I hope I get this right because I didn't write it down, but she's taken an entire property and turned it 360 degrees in Houston. I mean, lawn and everything. So she thinks big, and I think it's going to be a night to remember. So I invite you back for the 22nd. And in the meantime, there is going to be the Sundays with the Modern Tour at 1 p.m. this coming Sunday. We have with us this week architect Greg Abanez, and I don't know for sure what Greg is going to focus on, but I assume that it will be some aspect of the architecture or perhaps the art within the architecture and that relationship. These tours have been very interesting in the unique, varied, and informed insights that they provide from week to week. So I invite you to come back or to come on Sunday for that. I think that tour will probably meet at the information desk since there's no designated area, other designated area. And of course, those are free with the cost of admission. If you're a member, it's free altogether. Tonight we have artist Kristen Morgan here from LA, where she, after having taught for a period, now works solely in her studio on sculptures comprised primarily of fired and unfired clay that replicate true to scale objects. The work is represented in LA by Mark Zellwin Gallery and in New York by Zach Fuhrer Gallery. Kristen has lived most of her life in California, basically leaving, the best I can tell, only for graduate school in New York, where she received an MFA from Alfred University School of Ceramics in 1997. She was recently back in New York City, however, where she opened the Zach Fuhrer's new location in Chelsea with the inaugural exhibition, New York Be Nice, which is a title I love. Other recent solo exhibitions include Cellos and Objects for Everyone I Have Known, another title I love and am very curious about. Both of those exhibitions were at the Mark Zellwin Gallery. And then there also is the exhibition formerly known as Passengers 2.7, which was at the CCA Watts Institute for Contemporary Art in San Francisco. And this is just naming a very few of the long list of solo exhibitions in Kristen's career. Kristen's work was featured in Unmonumental at the New Museum in New York. Again, that was the inaugural exhibition for that space as well. She was also in Thing at UCLA, Hammer Museum of Los Angeles, Red Eye at the Rubel Family Collection in Miami, and currently Huckleberry Finn, again at the CCA Watts Institute for Contemporary Art in San Francisco. In the Zach Fuhrer press release, Kristen's work is described as capturing the complexity of the present by way of the past. The corroding surfaces of her objects not only capture the here and now, but project fragility, mortality, and decay. And more specifically, LA Times art critic Christopher Knight has written, "Melancholy does not merely waft into the atmosphere from Kristen Morgan's elaborately crafted clay, wire, and wood sculptures. It pours forth in torrents, filling the gallery with sadness that is palpable, almost unbearable." I guess we can judge for ourselves tonight as Kristen shares her work and ideas. And from the glimpse that I got earlier of the slides, I think possibly a little bit of her life as well. And since I got that glimpse, I've been very curious and very anxious to hear this presentation. So will you please join me in welcoming Kristen Morgan?
Hi. You can lower the lights. Who's ever lowering the lights? Okay. I like to talk about a lot of things that I like to look at, things that I think have to do with my work, and some things that I've paid attention to for a long, long time, and I think they have to do with my work, but I'm not really able to pinpoint what exactly. But the slide closest to me is, that's my family. Some of my works have to do with my family, but mostly they're just really sweet people, and they've always supported me and been very big fans. So I like to give them a shout out. I'm the oldest daughter of four girls, and I grew up in Northern California in San Jose for most of my life. I lived there. Now I currently live in Southern California. The picture furthest from me is a picture I found in a book a long, long time ago. There are only a few scraps of information I can remember about the photograph, and one is that it is a film still from a very old movie, but the title of the movie I don't know. And the other bit of information I know about this photograph is that the baby in the photograph grew up to be a director of horror films. And this photograph has always really appealed to me because the supposed horror of an infant being carried off by a giant bird is equally as horrific as an infant being carried off by a janky stage prop. And I like the fact that it's equally horrible no matter how you look at it. So. I have no idea who these people are. This is something that I do. I go to estate sales and I collect these slides of people who had no further use for their slide collections. The picture closest to me is a very early drawing that I did maybe around 1976 with color crayon, and it was based on a painting that I saw in Spain. My father, he was a chemist, and he was sent on a business trip to Spain, and he took the whole family with him to Spain, and for the first time in my life I saw all of this art, and I was completely captivated with Francisco Goya, and I wanted to grow up to become a painter. And so this was like a first attempt at painting. In this other photograph, that's a photograph of me and my best friend Michael Ress. I'm dressed as Jill from Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill, and Mike is dressed as the mouse from Hickory Dickory Dock, and it was the nursery rhyme day parade at kindergarten, and I am really, really, really sick. I have like 104 temperature, and this was all, there were months before this parade that I was getting ready for it, collecting Band-Aids and whatnot, and then I got, like, painfully ill. And this was a common occurrence when I was a child. I was chronically sick all the time. And but one thing that it did do is, it's because I was, bedridden, it sort of, it, it sort of heightened my skills for being observant, because I couldn't always participate in things, and so and it also just enriched, you know, certain skills. I had spent a lot more time drawing and observing than I could, you know, playing like other children. Because I was also an invalid, I spent a lot of time watching television. And my father was, he was a chemist, but he was raised on really awful science fiction movies and sort of like drilled them into us. And I was very receptive, and I really fell in love with horror films and at a very young age. This is Boris Karloff in Frankenstein, and you will find a lot of themes within horror films sort of peppered throughout my work. I also had this idea when I was a kid that all black and white films were of horror film kind of genre. I knew horror films came in color, but I was certain that all black and white films were definitely horror films. And so I ended up watching a lot of black and white films that were not horror films and would constantly be disappointed by this. But also I discovered, you know, there were actresses like Bette Davis here, and she would trick me a lot because she could be really horrifying. But I developed a kind of love for these other actresses and actors of the silver screen. And especially people like Bette Davis and Greta Garbo and Judy Garland, they were these people that sort of were able to outlive their own legendary status and became these really steely, tough people that, you know, you couldn't really knock down. This is a place that I visited. It's the House on the Rock. It's in Wisconsin, and it's the home of the world's largest carousel. There's some, I don't know, it's two stories and some 80,000 lights on it, and I don't know, 200 different animals. Not a single one of them is a horse. And this place was created by this man who was kind of a collector, but quite an eccentric man who built this home on top of a 50-foot rock above the forest in Wisconsin. And he just went out and started collecting things that he enjoyed to draw people to this home. And every time he collected things, he would add a new wing onto this house. And at some point, he built this three-story tall sea beast being attacked by a giant squid. And it's surrounded by models of every conceivable boat or ship that you can imagine. It's a really incredible place. These vehicles are photographs that I took on a trip to Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty. And I was actually more intrigued with this junk when I was out there than, well, the Spiral Jetty is beautiful. If you ever get an opportunity to go out there, it's a very eerie, strange, wonderful place. And this junk is no longer there, and I just totally fell in love with it. But it's been taken away by the state, but someday I want to make these things too, I think, if I have another couple of cars in me. These are photographs from one of my very favorite places in Los Angeles. It's no longer there. It's closed around 2005, and this is the Movieland Wax Museum. And this place was truly incredible in that it was huge, and it had every movie from Laurel and Hardy all the way up to more contemporary things with Britney Spears and Michael Jackson, and all these different movies. There was John Travolta, but every movie would come with its own sort of tableau, a set to look like the movie. And one of my favorite things was that they would take, they would retire certain things. So once in a while, you would come across, you know, a very odd tableau that was, everything in it was sort of taken out of context. You would have Batman on the set of a farmhouse on a Harley Davidson, and you didn't know why anything was there. So it was a really magical place. This is kind of a gruesome thing, and I know it has to do with my work, but I'm not really sure what. But this is a photograph. There's this baby, and he died around 1952. And it was a time when people no longer really photographed their dead children. And if your child died in 1952, it was kind of a shock and a very upsetting thing. But the thing that I love about this is that the parents really wanted to sort of reclaim something from this horrible event. And so they photographed the baby in his casket, and then they photographed him again, but they, it's hard to tell, but they pasted photographs of open eyes over his closed eyes so that they could remember what he looked like when he was alive. And so... on a lighter note, this was one of my teachers, and he, this man is named Clayton Bailey, and he was known for a lot of different things, but one of the things he became very well known for was, he used to say that he liked the idea of hunting for dinosaurs, but he didn't like to travel. So he decided to make his own, and he built this enormous skeleton and buried it in his backyard. And then it rained, and he went out into the backyard, and he invented a pseudonym for himself. He said he was Dr. Gladstone, and he said that he had recovered the remains of a Bigfoot. And he went all over the country giving lectures on his Bigfoot finds, and he told you exactly how you could go out yourself and find your own Bigfoot remains. And he invented this pseudo-scientific language where he said he had found the Chaolithic remains of the pre-credulous era of Bigfoot. And, you know, and he gave these very intense, very long lectures, and eventually he made so many remains that he opened his own museum that was called the Museum of Unnatural History. And for a quarter, you could take tours of it. But the one thing that he told me was that there was a time and place for a practical joke, and fine art is a really great place for a practical joke because absolutely nobody expects it. So, I'm totally in love with the dodo bird. This particular animal went extinct within 80 years of its discovery and extinction. It was discovered, and then 80 years later, it was totally wiped off the planet. And it was discovered at a time when natural history museums were really in their infancy. And the way that they would collect specimens, they'd just go out and get one and stuff it, and then moths would eat it, and they'd throw it away, and they'd go out and get another one. They went out to find another specimen from the dodo bird because it had been thrown away, and there were no dodo birds left. And so all of our imagery, all of our ideas of what this animal looked like are completely fictitious. And that's one thing I really like about this animal, is that we have this idea that we know what this animal looks like, but we really don't. So this is like a quick overview of different pieces that I've made, and just to give you different ideas of different things that I've made. These are two cars. The car closest to me was based on several different years of Cadillac. And it's all made out of unfired clay that is glued essentially to wood and wire armature. And this other car is kind of based on a child's pedal car. I had just seen Bonnie and Clyde's Model T Ford that they were gunned down in, and I was totally infatuated with this car, and I wanted to make like a junior version of it. I also do really ridiculous things like this. These are play sets. So closest to me is Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet on the Titanic. And then furthest from me is the Goya's Third of May play set. These are all fired and glazed ceramics. And I do take these things really seriously. I like what happens when you place them next to this other type of work that I do. I find that I kind of repeat myself about every 7 years. And so these are cups, and these were made about 10 years apart. The cup closest to me, it was made out of, there's like a wire frame, and clay is glued to the wire, and then it's sort of, there's paint and paper and collage. This idea of collage comes up a lot in my work. And then furthest from me are cups that are fired and glazed, and I made all the drawings myself, but I do a lot of drawing on top of my drawing. Again, it's kind of like collage, but I'm making all of the collage aspects. These are two different photographs of my studios, two different studios that I held about 10 years apart. And this, you know, kind of chaos is something that I have quite often in my studio. These are very recent works that I've made, and I'm kind of really interested in this idea of a still life and these objects that are sort of placed together that might be really taken out of context, but that get a new context when you put them all together. So this piece is called 150 Ways to Play Solitaire, and there's a book here that's got the same title. These things are also all made out of unfired clay that has been painted. There's not a book or anything of the sort in the still life. This is a table. It's a fairly large table. It's called the repeating table. And the idea here is, I was kind of going off this idea that history sort of repeats itself. And so on, ooh, I love this pointer thing. So on this side of the table, these are all actual books and toys and cigarette boxes and things like that. On this side of the table, I have made all of these objects, but out of unfired clay and paint. So the idea is that history sort of repeats itself. I'm interested in remaking these objects as a kind of tributary thing, but in the end, both things are utterly doomed. You know, the paper things will disintegrate, and so will my tributes. They're essentially painted dirt. These are also more recent pieces, and I've been doing a lot of this sort of drawing on top of things. And so there's a giant squid here and a Tweety bird, and I think there's a Walt Disney little blue bird here, and there's some Smurfs over here and a mean Donald Duck. I take a lot of my imagery from warplanes and comics and also fine art as well. You'll find Giotto and Philip Guston sort of laced throughout these things. In this far piece, there is a dodo bird drawn right there. It's kind of hard to see, but it's on all of the comic books. Again, the comic books are all unfired clay that has been painted. These two pieces, these two horses, went together. And again, there's a lot more sort of drawing on the surface that really interrupts the form, but also informs it and gives it this other wider sort of context. I like to make cars, and this is my most recent car. James Dean was killed in 1955 in this Porsche Spyder, and the car that he died in was rumored to be cursed. And after he died in this car, parts of the car were put in other cars, and those cars also had fatal or near fatal accidents with the drivers of those cars. And then at some point, you know, these accidents had happened so often that the owner of the car sold the wreck to the highway patrol. And the highway patrol put the car on display all over the country to sort of promote highway safety. And at some point, the car was being driven on a truck back from Florida to LA, and the pink slip showed up, but the car was gone and was never to be heard of again. And so my idea at this time was to make a car that was really had no business being on the planet, and to kind of bring it back. Maybe not such a good idea. About midway through, I decided I really didn't want to make it, but I kind of had to. And so this car consequently took me about 6 months to build. And but I did really like the way it turned out. But I'm glad it's over with. So all this unfired clay is fairly unconventional for ceramics. Usually for something technically to be ceramics, it has to be fired in a kiln. And I first started making this work when I was in graduate school in a very unlikely place at a very traditional graduate school. Known as Alfred. Alfred is, you know, a kind of mecca for ceramics, and they want you to glaze and fire things. So when you say in the middle of your first semester that you don't want to fire things, you're asking for trouble. And so, but that's what I did, and it started with this piece. This has, like, there's a violin in there. It's sometimes hard to see. But I made it, and I had intended to fire it, but it just sort of sat around in my studio. And I wanted it to kind of look like this music that I was listening to, particular pieces of violin music. And I thought that it was this very fleeting thing, and it sort of made sense that it should be this very fragile work of art, that it should look fragile and that it should be fragile. So I left it, and I continued making these objects that looked fragile. And the fragility kind of gave the work a mortality that artworks have. You know, like if you put a painting out in the rain, it will go bad. But it's really very evident on the sleeves of this work. It's very apparent that it's very fragile, and people get very squeamish about it, owning it. So, these are some places that I visited and that I inhabited when I was in graduate school. This is my studio, and I was known as the girl with the messy studio, and actually this floor is a false floor. I had built up about a foot of rubble on my floor, and every time my faculty would speak to me about my work, we would talk about the mess in my studio and not really so much about my work. And so I really wanted them to kind of see my work, so I just built a false floor over the existing rubble. I felt like I needed the rubble. I couldn't throw it away, so I just built a level over the top of it. This picture over here, this is from a health spa, an abandoned health spa that I used to visit when I was in graduate school. This is another picture from the health spa. It was about 5 stories tall, and it was first opened in the 1850s by a guy named Bernard McFadden. And he was a contemporary of Kellogg and believed that if you could go there and on a regiment of exercise and enemas, and you could lose weight and vacation. It was a very beautiful place. I really love those places. And this is an abandoned mercury mine that I used to trespass on, and also used to inform my work quite a bit. About a year after graduate school, I was invited to be a visiting artist at Cal State Long Beach. And I was there for just one summer, and I built a ton of work, but really one of the more important things that I made was this piano. When I was in school, it was a really hard thing to justify why I was making all this work out of unfired clay. I just didn't have a very recipient audience. So when I got out of school, I was very excited to make all this work out of all this mixed material. So this is plaster and clay and wood and wire and string and all these materials that I could get my hands on. And also it was a fairly large work. And I could just see that it was possible for me to make things on a larger scale. So these next works I made around the year 2001.